Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 372. What's going on here? Part three, being recorded on August 11th of the year 2002. In this broadcast, I'm illustrating what I believe is an analogous structural relationship between elements in the United States in positions of power within industry and finance and elements in similar positions in Saudi Arabia. And within this relationship, within the context of this structural relationship, I believe that what I call the underground Reich is assaulting the United States not only from without, as was evident on September 11th, but also from within, and I'm suggesting a parallel, an analogy, between the structural relationship that existed in France prior to and during World War II, between German industrialists and financiers and their counterparts, in particular their counterparts in the French steel industry, and the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. It is these structural economic relationships which in turn are permitting an attack on and subversion of the United States by what I call the underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground. And I believe that the U.S. situation is analogous to the situation in France prior to and during World War II. I'm not saying there's such a thing as, in fact, I don't believe that there is such a thing as a perfect analogy, but when I have described the September 11th attacks as being similar to what France underwent in World War II, where it was attacked from without at the same time as that attack was used by some interests who really sought the dissolution of French democracy, that attack from without was used by internal elements associated with these structural economic elements to subvert France from within, and that accounted for the rapid French capitulation in World War II. If this seems complex, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 371 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website later on in the week. Also note that the Spitfire website is equipped with real audio and that there are links in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. Those websites have more recent articles, more recent programs rather, streaming on real audio at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL. Now, in terms of constructing the analogy between France and the pre-World War II and early World War II period and the United States in regard to its relationship not only to Saudi Arabia, but to something which underlies the reality of Saudi Arabia, namely what I call the underground Reich, perhaps culturally exemplified by the ubiquitousness of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, not only in Saudi Arabia but elsewhere in the Middle East, that does not come from the Middle East. Now, turning again to the book All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin that we used in the first half of this broadcast, James Stewart Martin, one of the key people in charge with it attempting to interdict some of the U.S.-German industrial relationships, some of these structural relationships, which in turn hampered the U.S. war effort and which not only were central to the German war effort, but which helped to bring about fascism in Germany in the first place by lending key support to Adolf Hitler in the 1932 election. When discussing the relationship between the French Comité de Forges and the de Wendel family and the Rauchling family in Germany, whom they aided against French national interest in both World War I and World War II, bear in mind that in turn this structural relationship between the French steelmakers and industrialists and the German coal producers and industrialists in Germany and the German Steel Trust, bear in mind that their German steel cartel, I should say, bear in mind that the financing of Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, the Thyssen firm that we're going to hear about, that came from the United States and the development capital, the venture capital, to combine the French, the German steel interests, in turn linked to their counterparts in France. This came from the United States. And note that William Draper was in charge of the economic reconstruction of Germany. He also, in addition to helping to finance German heavy industry and Third Reich industry in the first place, he also was very close to the elder George Bush. His son, William Draper III, helped to finance the younger George Bush's business ventures. And his son, Tim Draper, is a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who has been very active on behalf of school voucher initiatives here in California. So it's all in the family. But of the Thiessen, Draper, German steel interest relationship to the Wall Street financiers, James Stuart Martin writes as follows. The mid-20s were remarkable for German industrial combination. They marked the formation of the United Steelworks in Germany, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, as a combination of the four biggest steel producers, Ernst Pungsen, Fritz Thiessen, again a partner of the Bush family, Otto Wolff, and the others who drew this combine together had managed to get over $100 million from private investors in the United States. I would note that $100 million in the 1920s was a huge, huge sum of money. Continuing. Dillon Reed and Company, the New York investment house which brought Clarence Dillon, James V. Forrestal, William H. Draper Jr., by the way, a close Bush family ally, and others into prominence, floated the United Steelworks bonds in the United States behind a glowing prospectus which declared that the United Steelworks Corporation, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, quote, will be the largest industrial unit in Europe, and one of the largest manufacturers of iron and steel in the world, ranking in productive capacity second only to United States Steel Corporation, unquote. The formation of United Steel, or Vereinigte Stahlwerke, gave its management tremendous power in Germany, enough to carry through without delay the organization of the German domestic steel cartel, and to guarantee the good behavior, unquote, of all German steel companies in their agreements with foreign firms. So again, note the relationship here of some of the Thiessen Bush relationships that we've discussed in the past, and of course bear in mind the connections between the Thiessen Axis and the Bormann Organization, or Underground Reich, as I call it. Now, in terms of constructing the analogy that I believe is a valid one, although by no means perfect, that we're talking about almost 70 years in time, but the analogy between France in the 30s and early 40s and the United States in the run-up to and in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks should be understood again as a structural economic relationship within which conspiratorial, fascist, and subversive processes are allowed to take place. And note again that the destruction of the French Republic in the early years of World War II and their rapid capitulation was due not only to an attack from without, but from subversion from within by elements that in turn were connected to the aggressor. And it is in that type of relationship that I believe that the U.S. situation in 2002 is analogous to the French situation prior to and during the early years of World War II. We're going to take a look now at a book called Triumph of Treason. This was authored by Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T, who was the French Minister of Aviation under Léon Blum's Social Front for the French government. Triumph of Treason by Pierre Cot was published by Ziff Davis Publishing Company and copyright 1944. So this book was published before the end of World War II. Now, in this book, Pierre Cot, who again was the French Minister of Aviation and who struggled against some of the forces of French reaction to modernize the French Air Force and to put the French military on a competitive basis with the Nazis, unfortunately, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M60, available from Spitfire, many of the more powerful interests in France not only were connected to some of their German counterparts. And again, we took a look at the De Wendels running of interference for the German Rockling family in both World Wars. They helped to spare Rockling interests in World War I while the two countries were at war. And then the Rocklings got key contracts to help make the Maginot Line. What we're going to talk about here, courtesy of Pierre Coe and Triumph of Treason, is the rapid capitulation of the French military in World War II. This due to the activities in part of a powerful fascist fifth column in France. And I believe that there is a similar fifth column in the United States, marrying American fascist elements to Islamo-fascist elements. And I believe, in turn, the structural relationship between American oil companies and Saudi Arabia is in some ways analogous to the relationship between the French heavy industrialists and their counterparts in Germany. That relationship translated into the onto the battlefield as follows. Again, Pierre Coe, writing in Triumph of Treason from 1944. Talking about the condemning of the social front of Léon Blum for the rapid collapse of the French army, and this condemning being done by the very fascist elements that had subverted the French army, Pierre Coe writes as follows. First of all, it was necessary to preserve the honor of the army, unquote. General Weygand thundered these words like a command. He was one of the French generals who would help to deliver the French to the Germans. Speaking of Weygand, he used unconsciously the same terms that leaders of the French army had invoked during the Dreyfus affair to prevent public opinion from discovering their criminal mistakes. Preserve the honor of the army to French military men is to secure by every means, including those outlawed by moral law and the penal code, the defense of the military establishment. This again against charges of having basically blown it in the war against the Germans in World War II. Continuing. The question of the responsibility of military leaders in the military defeat of France either had to be evaded or posed in distorted terms. To preserve the honor of the army, unquote, the scapegoats of the defeat had to be chosen from among the political personnel of the Third Republic. Again, that was the Blum government of which Coe was part. Continuing. In truth, at the end of June 1940, the question of who was responsible was in everyone's mind. In the 2 weeks preceding the armistice, I was in touch with the crowd of refugees that slowly and painfully followed the road southward. In the offices of the prefects, in the town halls, restaurants, and relief centers, I listened to many conversations, received many confidences, heard many opinions. Opinions differed on governmental policy, but all agreed in denouncing the blunders of the French general staff. The country was unanimous not against Blum, Daladier, or even against Laval, Pierre-Étienne Flandin, Georges Bonnet, or Jacques Doriot, but against the generals who had been incapable of understanding the conditions of modern warfare and who were guilty of not knowing the rudiments of their profession. Quote, just as before 1914 they had prepared for the war of 1870, the people said, before 1939 they prepared for the war of 1914, unquote. And again, I believe there were bureaucratic blunders of the most profound sort, which obviously were evident in the failure to prevent September 11th. I also believe that, as was the case in France, there was active subversion of the investigation into bin Laden and the possibility that the attacks could have been prevented by a fascist fifth column. Some of the undermining of the anti bin Laden effort was due to the economic efforts within the context of the structural relationship, but within the context of that structural relationship, domestic and European and Islamo-fascist elements, I believe, are at work to subvert and destroy the United States. Continuing. The severest condemnation of the French general staff came from the soldiers themselves. Lost on the roads in pursuit of dispersed divisions and phantom regiments, thrown together with the refugees whose uncertainties and anxieties they shared, the men in uniform cursed the conduct of their own leaders. They repeated that they had never been schooled in the techniques of modern warfare, especially in the combined use of tanks and aviation, and they were amazed at the ineptness of their own commanders in the battles of May and June. They asked why the Meuse and Seine bridges had not been blown up before the arrival of German motorized columns, why Paris had not been defended street by street as the Spanish Republicans had defended Madrid, and as the Russians were to defend Stalingrad. And they wanted to know why more than half of the tanks and airplanes had been left in the rear, in Orléans, Toulouse, Lyon, North Africa, instead of being massed for a counterattack that might have changed everything on the battlefield. They knew that the depot were bursting with the cannon, airplanes, and equipment they had needed. One began to hear quoted the disturbing remarks with which General Weygand had tried to persuade the cabinet to ask for an armistice, that he needed his tanks to master the revolutionary elements at home if it should become necessary. That is to say, the commander-in-chief of the French army preferred fighting French workers to throwing all of his forces against the French troops. The soldiers praised the bravery of certain leaders, Giraud, Lestien, de Gaulle, Lucien, Delattre de Tassigny, and many others, but they declared that most of the officers had been the first to flee. Quote, "They left in automobiles, and we left on foot," they said, talking about those officers. "Faithful followers of L'Action Française, Je suis partout, Gringoire, and the other French fascist newspapers, which had said in various forms during the winter that this was a democratic war and consequently did not interest them." And speaking again about the rage against the generals in France, by June of 1940, not one man, unless he were directly involved, would have defended the general staff. The most indulgent spoke of incompetence, the most severe of betrayal, and the latter were in the majority. Moreover, available information about war prisoners indicated that these unfortunates were still more bitter against their leaders than were their comrades in France. Their anger was legitimate. It was inexplicable, after all, that the general staff, after deciding to abandon Paris and thus opening the east to the Germans, had not ordered the troops which occupied the Maginot Line to fall back toward the south. More than 1 million men, the best of the French army, were caught in the German trap, a disaster which could have been prevented by an order from General Weygand. And again, it was the opinion of many that, quite simply, the French general staff, in line with the interests of elements like the de Vendels and the Comité de Forges, were really much more enamored of Hitler than of their own countrymen, whose interests they, if not actively opposed, whose potential power they feared. After the Vichy fascist collaborationist government was set up in France on behalf of elements like the de Vendels and promptly dropping the 40-year sentence against the Roquelings, as we looked at in Side 1, the blame for the defeat was deflected away from the fascist Fifth Column and onto the social front of Léon Blum. Continuing with Triumph of Treason, by its composition, the government of Vichy was representative not of the French people, but of the general staff. Its first cabinets were headed by Maréchal Pétain, the spiritual leader of the French army, the man who had played the most important part in the preparation of the war and in the formation of the general staff. And these cabinets were composed largely of members of the general staff, General Weygand, General Pujol, Admiral Dalin, General Hunsinger, General Bergeret, and Admiral Platon. As the French proverb says, the wolves do not eat each other, skipping down. To their astonishment, the French people saw Maréchal Pétain slowly fill the most important posts of authority in local, departmental, and central administrations with men who had taken part in the fascist Cagoulard plot of 1938, with those who had repeated the infamous refrain, "Rather Hitler than Léon Blum," and even with some of those who before or during the war had been arrested for treasonable domestic and foreign activities. The people were applying to the government the old proverb, "Tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are." They were alarmed to see Vichy employ for its most delicate missions Ferdinand de Brinon, Jean Montigny, Jean Goy, Jean Lucher, and Gaston-Henri A., members of the Comité France-Allemagne, an organization which before the war had been inspired and financed by Otto Abetz, after 1940, Hitler's ambassador in Paris. They learned with fury that on the night of the armistice, when France was in mourning, Frenchmen and French women of the aristocracy, high finance, and industry had drunk at Bordeaux to the defeat which had rid them of the nightmare of democracy and of the popular front. The people understood that the fifth column in France, as in Spain, had opened the door to Hitler's agents, and they watched with awe the agents of the fifth column become masters of France, the France of Pétain, Weygand, and Laval. And still later, this fascist fifth column, which was to subvert France in the early stages of World War II, and which in turn was able to operate within some of the structural relationships between French heavy industry and German heavy industry. And again, I believe there is a similar an analogous fifth column at work in this country, in which domestic fascists, the heirs in some cases to some of the imports of the Crusade for Freedom, and Islamo-fascists associated not only with the power elite in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, but also with the power elite in the United States, as exemplified in the Talat Otman, Abdullah Baksh, George Bush connection. I believe a similar fifth column is subverting the United States today, and I think that in the event of another disastrous terrorist incident, we should consider very carefully what the future of the country is going to be and just how much we wish to tolerate from interests like Saudi Arabia. Turning to discussion of the French Fifth Column in Triumph of Treason, again, this book was written in 1944. Pierre Coe writes, "The activity of the Fifth Column will not be considered by historians as a special phenomenon of French public life only, but as an integral part of fascism. The Fifth Column has appeared wherever fascism is trying to gain a foothold. It was at work in Spain, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before it turned up in France, and there are Fifth Columns in the United States, India, and Latin America. By Fifth Column, I do not mean only spies and licensed traitors. The Fifth Column includes all who, by accepting fascist doctrines or methods, become the conscious or unconscious accomplices of a foreign power. Treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. The general staff of the Fifth Column consists principally of ambitious men who try to seize power by destroying or paralyzing the democratic system. The body of the Fifth Column is composed of people who think they are saving their country from the communist menace or British imperialism, and who do not even know in whose favor their actions are operating. Through hate of the popular front, good Frenchmen or men who consider themselves such served Hitler gratuitously by doing work to which they would never have consented had they been offered payment. Why? Because they detested the Republic and democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining any sort of order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these very same dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the Judeo-Masonic influence and Europe from the communist peril. These people, who had never read Marx, considered the Marxist danger, unquote, more immediate than the Hitlerian danger. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of collaboration with Hitler's new order, unquote. Skipping down in Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe, enough evidence has been published already to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new St. George who would slay the communist dragon. Again, I'm not suggesting this is a precise analogy, but I believe we have something similar in the United States, which is deathly afraid of democracy and which is actively working on behalf not only of an underground Reich, but which is using some of the structural relationships within the petroleum industry and Saudi Arabia to effect what ultimately will be either the destruction or subjugation of the United States. Continuing with Pierre Coe's discussion of the fifth column in France, when Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, "We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic," when Elie Bois, former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939-1940 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a government of authority, unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory, we have every reason to accept their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events themselves. Skipping down again. France received no exceptional treatment from Hitler and fascism. A general plan coordinated the activity of the fifth columns all over the world. All were recruited from the same circles and had the same social and political composition. The object was the same everywhere, to divide and unnerve public opinion, weaken the resistance of the regime, and prepare a governmental group ready to execute a fascist coup d'etat at a moment of trouble or confusion. The methods were the same everywhere. Cultivation of the seeds of disunity which normally exist among free men and in free countries, exaggeration and inflammation of all racial and religious conflicts, all class rivalries, all political antagonisms, gradual conversion of opposition and dissent into hate, creation of an atmosphere of civil war. The means used were the same everywhere. Campaigns of calumny against the democratic leaders capable of opposing fascism, Blum in France, Roosevelt in the United States, the development of anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is the first manifestation of racism and contains in petto the whole doctrine of Hitler, use of the fear of communism among the middle classes, because anti-communism is the best way to prevent the union of all anti-fascist forces. This last device has been the most efficacious. The fear of communism has become, in Europe and American politics of recent years, a much more important factor than communism itself. Now, again, Pierre Coe was writing in 1944, and I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing the conditions of the United States and the conditions of France in the 30s and 40s as being identical. There are some significant differences. But in terms of understanding how a mortal enemy of the United States can attack the United States with impunity and then have the president basically kissing the head of state of that country, Crown Prince Abdullah, on his expletive deleted, again, I think examining the structural relationships in the U.S. between Saudi oil interests and American corporate interests, and examining the French heavy industrial connections to their counterparts in Germany, that in turn has led to a fifth column. And again, the elements composing that fifth column in turn are operating on different motives. Some of them are doctrinaire fascists or Islamo-fascists. Others simply want to keep the business going. Basically, they're just filling orders. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 371. What's going on here? Part 3 being recorded on August 11th of 2002. www.spitfirelist.com. We'll have a written description of this program, annotated and article length later in the week. And the For the Record section of the Spitfire website also linked to two URLs of sister station WFMU-FM, which have the For the Record series available on Real Audio, either streaming or for download only. This concludes For the Record 372. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.